Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant and Pete Musto. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, artists and rights activists are pushing the Cuban government to change a law that they fear will hurt creativity and increase censorship. The law is to take effect next month. It bars artists and musicians from providing their services in any place open to the public, including privately owned spaces, without first getting government approval. The Cuban government in 2010 adopted a reform measure to require government approval only for state-run places. Since then, artists and musicians have presented their work in private as part of a wider push for economic, social, and political reforms in Cuba. Artists and musicians have been able to produce more work and expand their offerings with increased internet access and greater freedom to travel. But that has also made it harder for the government to collect taxes and oversee their works. The new law worries some independent artists who fear they will not be able to get state approval. That could cost them their livelihood. Luis Puerta is an artist who has supported his family by selling his paintings in private. He told the Reuters news service, "I never thought of immigrating before, but now I am." Some believe the new law will prevent artists from speaking out. Luis Manuel Otero Alcantara describes himself as an artivist. The word is a combination of artist and activist. He said, "This is a measure of repression because you won't get government approval if you are not within the socialist ideology." Otero Alcantara has led a campaign against the measure. On social media, he and other artists have described it as a law that converts art into a crime. He and others have also hosted performances to protest the measure. They also have sent letters to Cuban officials. Marco Castillo, an artist with Los Carpinteros, said the law would be a painful return to a gray, anti-cultural past of censorship. He was talking about the early 1970s, when the Cuban government persecuted artists for what it said was a lack of support for the revolution. The government later apologized for the treatment. The Cuban government did not answer a request for comment from Reuters. State-run media reports say that Decree 349, as the law is known, aims to prevent tax avoidance and the spread of art done in bad taste or created to incite public disorder. There are signs that the artists are making their voices heard. Amnesty International has backed their campaign against the law. The organization warned that the law could be used broadly to crack down on dissent. The European Union also raised concerns about the law during recent talks with Cuba on human rights. The Communist Party newspaper Granma reported this month that the culture minister would work with artists to revise the law.
The city of San Francisco is home to some of the nation's largest technology companies, including Twitter and Uber. At the same time, it has one of the largest homeless populations in the country. Homelessness and job displacement for local people continue to rise. But one program is helping to connect the two worlds for job seekers. Del Seymour created the program. He was once homeless himself. For years, Seymour suffered from using illegal drugs.
And I wandered these streets like a zombie, day and night, for 18 years, using drugs, selling drugs, being arrested. I have 14 felony arrests in this neighborhood.
He spent those years in a neighborhood known as the Tenderloin, an area with an extremely high rate of homelessness and drug use. However, in recent years, large companies like Twitter, Airbnb, and Uber have moved in or near the Tenderloin area. But they started importing people from other regions and countries to work in the neighborhood, Seymour said. That was hard for Daniel Henry, a formerly homeless man who hopes to get a technology job.
My friends see how tech-savvy I am with it. You should be working in tech. And I was like, you're right. I should.
A few years ago, Seymour started making phone calls to technology companies. He thought it was unfair for the companies to ignore local people, including homeless ones. You're not going to come into my neighborhood and ignore my people, he said. You're going to include us in your business. To everyone's surprise, the companies started answering. As a result, Seymour started Code Tenderloin. It is a nonprofit organization that is giving homeless and other needy people a path to employment, including jobs in technology companies. The organization offers classes in coding for computer languages such as HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. It also gives 6-week training classes in job readiness. The class teaches students public speaking, resume building, interviewing, and other skills. Victoria Westbrook is Director of Programs and Operations at Code Tenderloin. She says the organization works with all kinds of people who have barriers to employment.
So that can mean anything from reentry, getting out of prison, homeless, at risk of becoming homeless, victims of or survivors of domestic violence. It could be pretty much anybody that's under or unemployed.
Code Tenderloin students visit technology companies to meet people, ask questions, and learn from employees. Alfonso Williams is a Code Tenderloin student. He says he enjoys each visit to a new tech company.
I learned something new. Hopefully I can learn something else. Coding, I'm really getting into coding.
There is no cost for classes at Code Tenderloin. And in some cases, computers are provided. Although only a small number of students have found full-time technology jobs, a number of others have gotten internships through the program. And many others have found other full-time jobs. I'm Alice Bryant.
Humans may have been enjoying cacao, the substance used to make chocolate, for much longer than experts had thought. Researchers at the University of British Columbia in Canada have found that humans grew cacao trees and consumed cacao starting around 5,300 years ago. They published their findings in the journal Nature, Ecology, and Evolution in late October. The researchers found evidence of cacao's use at an ancient village in the highlands of southeastern Ecuador. They examined the remains of very old objects at the Santa Ana La Florida archaeological site. The village was part of the Mayo Chinchipe culture of the Andes. Time has had little effect on the village and ceremonial center. The researchers were able to find a lot of evidence of the use of cacao. Scientists had already mostly agreed that cacao was first domesticated in South America instead of Central America, as they once believed. But the new discovery shows cacao was domesticated about 1,500 years earlier than was known before. The scientists found evidence of cacao being used at the site from 5,300 to 2,100 years ago. Cameron McNeil is a professor at Lehman College in New York. She is editor of the book Chocolate in Mesoamerica. She told the Associated Press that Santa Ana La Florida is the earliest site now with domesticated cacao. McNeil was not involved in the new research. The University of British Columbia researchers found extremely small pieces from the cacao tree in the remains of containers and other objects, as well as genetic material from the tree. They also identified a substance found in the cacao tree, but not in its wild relatives. This suggests that humans grew the tree for food purposes. A tropical tree known as Theobroma cacao produces large round pods that contain the bean-like cacao seeds. A soft, light-colored substance covers each seed. Today, the seeds are cooked and turned into many chocolate products. But thousands of years ago, cacao was used to make drinks. Michael Blake is a professor of archaeology at the University of British Columbia who helped lead the study. He said that the objects on which cacao was found suggest a lot about how people used the substance at the time. They clearly drank it, Blake told the Reuters News Service. There is no established history of indigenous populations in South or Central America using cacao to make chocolate the way people do now, the researchers reported. Indigenous populations in the upper Amazon area today still use cacao to make special drinks, they added. Archaeological evidence suggests cacao domestication moved into Central America and Mexico about 4,000 years ago. It is not clear how cacao's use spread between South and Central America. But by the time Spanish explorers arrived in Central America in the late 1400s, people were using it to make hot and cold chocolate drinks with spices. By the 1580s, Spain began importing cacao and spreading it to other European countries. By the 1800s, technology developed in the Netherlands made it possible to turn cacao into a solid chocolate product. Michael Lascanes teaches chocolate-making classes at the Institute of Culinary Education in New York. He said he has observed a growing interest in natural cacao tastes. He said he introduces his students to the history of chocolate. He tells his students, for example, about a recipe from the 1600s that mixed Mayan and Aztec versions of cacao drinks with European influences. Lascanes said chocolate is something that's always been transforming. I'm Pete Musto.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Gerald Ford. Ford was the 38th president, but he was never elected to the position. Instead, an unusual series of events brought him there. Many historians have described Ford as a good man facing a difficult situation. He tried to fix a troubled economy, end United States involvement in Vietnam, and show people that the U.S. government could continue to operate after a crisis. Critics from the two main political parties had problems with Ford's efforts, and voters did not elect him president when they had the chance in 1976. But he is remembered in American history for making many voters feel better about their elected officials. When he was born, the future president was given his father's name, Leslie Lynch King. But the boy's father was abusive. His mother separated from him a short time after their son was born. She asked a court for permission to cancel their marriage. Her request was quickly approved. She and the boy moved from the Midwestern state of Nebraska to Michigan. In a few years, the mother married a man named Gerald Ford. The couple had three sons together. The new family was warm and loving. In time, the oldest boy officially took his stepfather's name and became Gerald Rudolph Ford, Jr. He was called Jerry for short. Growing up, Jerry Ford was a well-liked person and a good student. He was also a top football player. He was named the most valuable player on his team at the University of Michigan. After finishing college, he was offered work with professional football teams. But Ford wanted to continue his education instead. He accepted coaching positions for the football and boxing teams at Yale University in Connecticut. In time, he attended the law school there. Ford's path to politics was similar to that of other presidents during that period. He worked at a law office in his home state. He fought in World War II. He married. Ford's wife was Elizabeth Bloomer. Her friends called her Betty. She had been a dancer and worked as a fashion model. The Fords went on to have four children. When Gerald Ford was 35 years old, he launched his political career. The Republican Party chose him as its candidate for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. Ford was elected to represent his home area of Grand Rapids, Michigan. But unlike many other politicians, he did not move on to the Senate or become governor of a state. Instead, he stayed in the House of Representatives for 25 years. The job of congressman was, in many ways, a good choice for Ford. He was well-liked by many voters and other lawmakers. He could help different groups come to agreement. He took increasingly important positions on political issues, and in time became the top person in his party in the House. Ford was a strong supporter of Republican presidents. In the 1968 election, Ford advocated for Richard Nixon. Ford liked Nixon's plans for the United States as well as his efforts to improve relations with China and the Soviet Union. Both Ford and Nixon were re-elected to their positions in 1972. But by then, major problems had come to light in Nixon's administration. One problem in the early 1970s related to Nixon's vice president, Spiro Agnew. Agnew had been vice president since 1969. 5 years later, officials found evidence that he had accepted money from contractors, both while Maryland's governor and as vice president. In answer, Agnew resigned from the presidency. Normally, voters elect a vice president, along with a president, every 4 years. But by coincidence, the U.S. Constitution had recently been updated to say what happens if the country needs a vice president unexpectedly. It states that the president has to nominate someone for the position. Then, a majority of lawmakers in Congress must agree. So, in 1973, Nixon nominated Gerald Ford to take Agnew's position. Nixon was not especially close to Ford, but he knew a majority of lawmakers would likely accept him as vice president. They did. However, Ford did not serve in the position long. In 8 months, another unexpected event put him in the Oval Office. In August 1974, President Richard Nixon resigned from office. He was the first president to do so. As a result, the vice president, Gerald Ford, became president. Ford was sworn in as president on August 9, 1974. Then he spoke to the nation on television. He said, "My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over." He told people, "Our Constitution works. Our great republic is a government of laws and not men." The public had understandably lost a good deal of faith in government officials, and especially in Richard Nixon. Ford wanted to reestablish their trust. But a few weeks after taking office, Ford used his presidential powers to pardon Nixon. The pardon meant that Nixon would never face a criminal trial, or, if found guilty, punishment for his actions. Ford said he believed pardoning Nixon would help Americans begin to recover from their painful experience with the former president. But instead, the move angered many people. They believed that Nixon should be held responsible. They also lost some of their trust in Ford. In addition to these political troubles, Ford faced other difficult issues. The American economy was struggling. His administration had to deal with unemployment, inflation, and the lasting effects of an energy crisis. The high price of oil imports came at a time when Americans were using more and more gasoline. Ford took steps aimed at improving the economy, but critics said he was not consistent. Some criticized him for increasing government spending and cutting taxes. Others criticized him for reducing government spending and raising taxes. Ford also oversaw the withdrawal of Americans from Vietnam. An earlier agreement had brought a ceasefire to groups in South Vietnam, North Vietnam, and communist forces. The U.S. officially withdrew its combat troops in 1973, but the fighting restarted. Ford asked Congress to approve military and humanitarian aid for the area, but U.S. lawmakers did not approve the full amount, and in time, they cut military aid. In 1975, communist forces began to take control of Saigon, the capital of South Vietnam. Ford ordered all remaining Americans in the country to leave, along with any South Vietnamese who were connected to the United States. He said that, as far as Americans were concerned, the Vietnam War was finished. Americans did not appear to blame Ford for the troubling end of the country's involvement in Vietnam, and some recognized that the country's economic and energy problems had started long before he became president. But in general, Ford did not have the support of Congress, and many voters did not forgive him for pardoning Nixon. In 1976, Ford officially campaigned for president for the first time. He won his party's nomination in a close race against Ronald Reagan, the former governor of California. But he lost the general election to the Democratic candidate, who said one of his best qualities was that he did not have experience in the federal government. The argument appeared persuasive to many voters, who still did not appear to be enthusiastic about the government. In the 1976 election, nearly half of all people who were legally able to vote chose not to. Ford left the presidency graciously. He said that, because he had not planned to be president, he was thankful for the unexpected opportunity. Although Ford said he was ready to retire from politics, he continued to be active in public life. He advised others on government affairs, published books, and sat on boards and committees. His wife, Betty Ford, also left a lasting effect on the public. As First Lady, she had spoken about her experience with breast cancer. After her husband left the presidency, she also spoke openly about her battle with alcohol and drug abuse. In 1982, Betty Ford co-founded the Betty Ford Center in California to help people get treatment for drug addiction. She announced her husband's death in 2006. Gerald Ford died of heart disease at the age of 93. By that time, most of the public had accepted that one of Ford's biggest achievements was to help the country recover after Nixon resigned. President Bill Clinton gave Ford a Presidential Medal of Freedom for his efforts. And even Jimmy Carter, who beat Ford in the 1976 presidential election, began his inauguration speech by thanking Ford. Carter said, "For myself and for our nation, I want to thank my predecessor for all he has done to heal our land."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.